But tonight, we're glad to see you back with us as we close the Lord's Day. Once again, coming together to worship and praise His name, and now to open up His Word and to study from His wonderful story. Though we usually talk about this in the morning, like I said, I swapped the lessons. And so we're going to talk about the life of David in the evening lesson. And we've come to 2 Samuel chapter 2 in a lesson that I've entitled Turned Tables. And I want you to think about a situation in your life where maybe you felt like you were on the bottom. Maybe somebody was doing something to you, causing life to be hard on you. Maybe circumstances were just against you, and you felt, man, things are really at the bottom for me. And then at some point, the tables turned, and now you're on top. I want to ask you, how did you handle that situation, or those situations? Maybe it was more than one for you. We're going to talk a little bit about that. As with the death of Saul, and that's what we talked about last time, the death of Saul, it seems to me that the tables now are turned. And how is David and his men now going to react now that the tables are turned? But in the death of Saul, we talked about that this really was a difficult funeral. If you even look at that story and see that there's a funeral at all, it really was a difficult funeral because the life that Saul lived was a very selfish, a very physically pleasing, a very pathetic life of a man that decided to make all the wrong decisions and to pursue all the wrong things. It didn't have to be that way with Saul. But with the death of Saul, we now probably presume that the Lord's anointed has been removed. And now that it's time for David to take the throne. Well, as we talked about before, I think the first lesson that comes out of chapter 2 is that of waiting on the Lord, waiting on God. I mean, David has been the quintessential example of that. David made sure in those 7, 8, 9 years that he ran for his life as Saul pursued him, to make sure that he waited on God. That was kind of his theme during that time, that no matter how evil Saul was, he is still the Lord's anointed. And he's going to allow the Lord to determine when He takes him off the throne. And in fact, on a couple occasions, he has opportunity to take matters in his own hands to kill Saul, and he doesn't do it because of that very rationale. He is the Lord's anointed. I'm not going to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. In fact, in chapter 1, there was an Amalekite who decided to use the death of Saul to his advantage. And came, as we talked about, it seems that he made up this whole story that he was the one that killed David's enemy. He was the one that killed Saul. Now he brings the crown to David. And I could just imagine this Amalekite is thinking he's going to be exalted by David. And instead, David has him taken out by his men and killed. And reiterates before all of that, he should have feared stretching out his hand against the Lord's anointed. David doesn't even wonder if this man's making this story up. He takes him at his word and has the man put to death based on what he has confessed doing to Saul. So David knows that all about waiting on the Lord. And as we read this story, as any good Bible student, we're thinking in our mind, well, Saul is dead. The Lord has removed his anointed. David is the second anointed, I guess we could put it that way. And now the kingdom is his for the taking. But as we get to chapter 2, we have to say, wait a second, not so fast. Look, if you would, at chapter 2 and the first 4 verses. 2 Samuel 2, 1 through 4. Then it came about afterwards that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." So David then said, "Where shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." I want you to notice again this outstanding character of David. We didn't see this in the life of King Saul. But David, what he inquires of the Lord, he wants to know the Lord's answer, just like we talked about this morning, as we talked about Acts 15 and God's authority. So David went up, verse 2, David went up there with his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, "It was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul." And David goes on to honor those men because of what they did, how they honored King Saul. But you say, well, wait a second. Verse 4 says that they anointed David as king. Right? David's already been anointed by the Lord, but now the men anoint David as king. That's true, but notice it's not Israel. It's simply the men of Judah. And so he does become king, but just of that southern tribe, just of his own tribal territory of Judah. Notice, if you will, what happens to the rest of Israel, verse 8. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army. So this is Saul's general, been faithful to Saul, fought for Saul, and apparently had survived the same battle that Saul and his sons died in. Abner had taken Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, and over the Asherites, and over the Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, even over all of Israel. And Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he became king over Israel. And he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. And so, when we talk about the divided kingdom, you often think about the divided kingdom much later than this, don't you? You think about Solomon's son, Rehoboam, making that foolish decision to listen to the young men, not the wiser older men, and eventually the kingdom divides. Well, actually, that kingdom divided even before. This is the first divided kingdom. You have Ish-bosheth, the one surviving son of Saul, who's been placed on the throne of Israel by Abner, the general. And so he's ruling over that northern portion, those northern tribes that we come to know as Israel. And David is also ruling, but ruling over just Judah, only Judah. And I think it is important for us to understand that God does answer a little bit of the promise he made to David. David does stop his running. David now does become king, just not over all of Israel. And so that, to me, as I read this, and I'm just giving you my impressions as a Bible student here, I find out, wow, this is a great lesson. I think David's ready to take over. Saul's gone, but not so fast. Now there's another one on the throne, Ish-bosheth, and David has to wait a little bit longer and a little bit more. What about us? You know, I would imagine most of us think that waiting on the Lord is probably one of the hardest parts of our faith, of our walk with Christ. Waiting on God, we know, is sometimes necessary, but it can be hard. And it requires of us a number of things. Some of them I'm going to talk about right now. Number one, it requires of us trust. Trust. You know, a lot of our waiting might be based on a prayer that we're praying to God and we're looking for that answer. Maybe it's something that has happened to us. Something in our life that we're wanting God to take charge of and bring an end to or change. In other words, turn the tables. And it takes trust. Trust that, one, God's answer will be the best. Even though it might not be our answer. Remember Paul in Corinthians, who prayed that the thorn in his flesh would be taken away. Prayed three times until he got the answer. And God's answer was no. But there was a purpose, there was a reason. God wanted to teach Saul through that answer. And Paul, I keep saying Saul, Paul trusted God that was the best answer, accepted that answer. Secondly, we need to trust God that when He answers, His timetable is better than ours. And that's what some of the hard part of waiting on God is, that sometimes God's timetable is a lot longer than ours. And so when we wait on God, sometimes our faith is really challenged as to our trust. But again, as I've said many times before, if we can have the perspective that this is an opportunity for us to show God just how strong our trust in Him really is, that perspective is going to go a long way in helping us to do the right thing as we wait. Secondly, it takes patience. And obviously, we think about waiting, we think about patience, right? And that's what it requires us. Again, being patient. And while we're patient, being obedient, doing the right thing as we're waiting for God's answer, as we're waiting upon the Lord. I've known several of you have gone through difficult situations during my time here. And I've seen how you've waited on the Lord. And I've seen how it's prolonged itself. And I've shaken my head sometimes and just been amazed at the faith and the trust and the patience that you've had along with the obedience. But there is temptation that comes as we wait on the Lord. And sometimes what happens is we just kind of, we lose our patience. And when we start to lose our patience, we start to think for God. I see that all the time. We start to think for God. For example, a couple having trouble in their marriage and just getting tired of waiting for God to answer their prayers, waiting for things to change, and finally just losing that patience and saying, it's over. And after you hear that, pretty soon you're going to hear something like this: well, God just wants me to be happy. And that is just thinking for God. That's a person that's just lost their patience, decided what? They're not going to be obedient. And now they're going to think for God so that it all smooths over. I remember that very situation, a very famous singer, very, very religious, left her husband or children for another man. And found solace. Her answer was the grace of God. God wants me to be happy, and God's grace wipes it all away. What was she doing? She was thinking for God. We need to be very careful with that. Let's look at some passages about waiting on God. Isaiah 64, verse 4. From of old they have not heard, nor perceived by ear. Neither has the eye seen a God besides thee who acts in behalf of the one who waits for him. A little background here. This is a section, Isaiah, where God basically takes on the idols. That Israel is just giving their heart away to these idols, taken away from God. And God says, okay, enough is enough. I'm going to take on these idols. I want you to compare the idols and their ability to what I can do. And there's some great passages about the character, the nature, the power of God in Isaiah 60 and on. But in this passage, look at what he says. Basically, he says, you have never seen a God like this. A God who acts. A God who's going to get into a person's life, and he's going to make things happen through this person, and he's going to act upon this person. But it's not just the obedient one, it's the one who what? He says, waits on him. I love this passage from the prophet Micah, Micah 7:7-8, as God says through Micah, but as for me, I will watch expectantly for the Lord. I will wait for the God of my salvation. My God will hear me. Do not rejoice over me, O my enemy. Though I fall, I will rise. Though I dwell in darkness, the Lord is a light for me. All those points we just talked about, can you not see that in the path? You've got the trust, the confidence in there. You've got the obedience. You've got the patience. All from what Micah speaks about here. And one thing that you really see in this is that the one speaking, it's not about him. It's about God. Trusting in God, waiting on God. Don't rejoice over me, my enemy. Even though I fall, I will rise. And the idea there is God's going to lift me up. It's all about God. And I think that's the perspective we have to have. And so it's kind of amazing to me. Again, you think, you know, oh, I don't have to be patient anymore. David can take the throne. And though he does take it a little bit, that's not the full promise of what God made to him. And sometimes that's what happens, isn't it? Sometimes maybe God will answer a little bit. Maybe he'll take a little bit of that suffering away. Maybe he'll give us a little bit of what we're asking for. But the answer might be not all of it yet. Now, but not yet. And sometimes when we think our waiting is over, we learn we have to wait just a little bit more, like David did. Let's go back to 2 Samuel chapter 2, if you haven't been there. This is where we get that the tables are turned. You know, David and his men have been the ones being pursued over these last, you know, 7 to 10 years. They've had to run for their life. They have had the appearance that they are, you know, kind of the enemy of Israel. In fact, at the very end, he's living not in Israel, but he's down there an ally to the Philistines. But now with the death of Saul, David is not the weak one, he's the strong one. The tables are turned. He is not the one that has to run, but he has the power. He looks like the strong one. How's David going to handle that? How is David and his men going to handle it? I believe David handles it a lot better than his men do. As you go to chapter 2, verse 12 through 17, there is a meeting between the north and the south, between Israel and Judah, Ishbosheth and David. But it's not Ishbosheth and David that are present. It's their two generals and some of their 12 of their soldiers from each side. And I just want to tell you, my first reading of this was completely wrong. But that's what I think needs to be done. When we first read a passage, we want to read it and see, what do I think's going on here? And that's what I did. And then I started reading some commentaries and found out that I really was reading this wrong. In fact, all the commentaries agreed what was happening here. But let's look at verse 12, and then I'll tell you what I thought at first. It says, now Abner the son of Ner went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth, the son of Saul. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. The pool of Gibeon. A little side note, archaeologists have believed to uncover this very pool. They have discovered this pool where this meeting takes place. And so they sat down, one on one side of the pool and the other of the other side of the pool. My first impression of this is like a peace talk. Two sides have come together. They're sitting on the opposite sides of the table. And that they're going to talk about peace. That was my first impression. Then verse 14, Abner said to Joab, "Now let the young men arise and hold a contest before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Again, my impression was that this was going to be some type of nonviolent way to figure all this out. That these men were going to get up and kind of wrestle with one another, something along those lines. And that's what was going to kind of determine who was strong, who was weak. And so verse 15, so they arose and they went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, 12 of the servants of David. And each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, and they fell down together. And therefore that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is in Gibeon. And that day the battle was severe, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So what you have here is a turning of the tables. And now Joab and his men are the one pursuing Saul and his men. And my first impression of this was that Joab wanted to turn the tables and make Abner feel like the one running. And so he advised his men that this is not to be a wrestling match, but you grab them and you stab them and you do them in. What I found out was going on, and again, all the commentators agree on this, is that Abner was proposing that these 12 men get up and fight to the death. That was the intention of Abner. And Joab went along with it. This is reminiscent of the old westerns where two gunfighters would go out and whoever could pull out their gun, draw their gun, and shoot accurately, he would win. And the one who could not would not only lose, he would die. That appears to be what we have here. And so these 12 men, I would imagine, are either severely injured or at least half of them are dead. And what transpires is a civil battle, a civil war that breaks out as the tables are turned. You see, what I believe is going on, Abner tried to keep the tables turned toward Saul and parenthetically really to himself. What you're going to find out about Abner is that even though he's put Ishbosheth on the throne, he's really kind of, you know, it's all kind of about him. And that he's really kind of the king. He's really the one that's in charge. And we'll see more of that later on. Whereas Joab saw an opportunity to turn the tables toward David and, again, himself. And so some of the results of this is that Joab's own brother is killed as he is now pursuing Abner. There's the turning of the tables. And Abner does not want to kill Joab's brother, but Joab's brother is faster than Abner, younger than Abner, and Abner says to him, turn aside. But Asahel will not do it, Joab's brother. And so Abner, the valiant warrior he is able to take the life of this very fast, very young soldier of Joab's brother. And Joab does not care for that at all. If you look at verse 30, 31, 32, they eventually do make peace, but here's the aftermath of all this turning of the tables. Joab returned from following Abner. Notice the words there. Joab was following or going after Abner. And when he had gathered all the people together, 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. That's Joab's brother. 20 altogether. But the servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 360 men died. Altogether, 380 Israelites die in the civil war, the civil battle. This is an ugly, ugly day in Israel's history. And when David finds out about it, he is not happy about it at all. This is kind of Joab and Abner taking charge themselves and trying to turn the tables one way or the other. And I see a temptation even in us. When the tables are turned and we are no longer on the bottom, we are on top. What is the temptation? Our temptation, a lot like Joab, I see, is that we seek to do what they did to us. Now we're on top. Now we have the power. Now we have the ability. Now we are the strong ones. Now we're going to do to them as they did to us. Why do we do that? Why do people do that when the tables are turned? Well, number one, there's something within us. And I think this is the fleshly nature within us. We want them to feel like they made us feel. There's some type of redemption in that. That if we can make them feel as bad as they made us feel, then there's some redeeming quality in that. And not only that, we want them to suffer like they made us suffer. We want them to have that same perspective of what they put us through. And there's a word the Bible uses for this. It's not a difficult word. It's not an elegant word. It's a word we know. It's called revenge. When the tables have been turned for us, have we reacted with revenge? Is that what our reaction was? When that's our reaction, that is not from God. That's from the devil. And understanding it from a human, fleshly perspective, I understand why people seek out to do that. Think that there's some redeeming quality. Makes us feel good if we can put them in our place. But that does not lead to the conquering of evil. As we see in this story, it leads to more evil. I want to look at a few passages as we close our lesson. Jesus himself, I believe, talked about this very point. Matthew 5, verse 39, "But I say to you, do not resist him who is evil, for whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also." You'll notice I have up here on the title of this slide, Revenge versus Defense, because I believe there's a lot of people that misunderstand this, what Jesus is saying, and therefore misunderstand the role of a Christian. Jesus is not talking about that a Christian cannot defend himself from evil. Just look at the Apostle Paul. Paul did not stand around and let people kill him. When he had opportunity, he escaped from that. We can as well, if we can't escape, we can defend ourselves. There's nothing in this that says we can't defend ourselves. For example, someone breaks into our house. This idea that Christians just have to roll over and let people who mean harm to us just do whatever they want or take whatever they want from us, that's not what Jesus is talking about. Jesus is talking about revenge. Is there some harm involved? Yes, a slap on the cheek. That's very different than somebody that wants to do harm to your family or wants to kill you or something along those lines. This is a person that slapped you on the cheek, that's taken your jacket. He's given us the recipe of how, in God's eyes, to defeat that evil action. And so he says, turn to him the other cheek. Don't, in other words, seek your own revenge, but kill him with kindness. I don't know if this is what Joab actually looked like. This is kind of what I picture in my mind about Joab. A very high-strung, a very energetic man who liked to fight his battles and win his victories out on the battlefield with the sword. And as the story of David and Joab goes on, you're going to see a conflict between David and his most loyal general, Joab, because their character is so different. But let's look at some passages, I think, that reflect exactly what Jesus is talking about. Romans chapter 12, verse 17. Romans 12, verse 17. So appropriate, so well known for this, but so appropriate as well. Romans 12, verse 17. Here Paul writes by inspiration, never pay back evil for evil to anyone. Respect what is right in the sight of all men. If possible, so far as it depends on you, be at peace with all men. Never take your own revenge, beloved. But leave room for the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I'll repay, says the Lord. But if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. I think that first statement in verse 21 probably speaks pretty well of Joab, maybe even of Abner himself. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 15. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 15. Where Paul writes these words, see that no one repays another with evil for evil, but always seek after that which is good for one another and for all people. And finally, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. 1 Peter 3, verse 8 through 13. To sum up, all of you, be harmonious, sympathetic, brotherly, kind-hearted, and humble in spirit. Not returning evil for evil or insult for insult, but giving a blessing instead. For you were called for the very purpose that you might inherit a blessing. For the one who desires life, to love and see good days, he must keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. He must turn away from evil and do good. He must seek peace and pursue it. For the eyes of the Lord are toward the righteous, and his ears attend to their prayer. But the face of the Lord is against those who do evil. Who is there to harm you if you prove zealous for what is good? This is a major theme, a major part of Christianity. And it's probably most tempting to us when we were on the bottom, but now the tables are turned and we're on top. You know what will keep you on top? Doing what we often like to call taking the high road. When you take the high road, you're not seeking revenge. You're doing the right thing, no matter how hard it is. That's our lesson tonight. Waiting on God and not seeking our own revenge, especially when the tables are turned to our advantage. I want to end tonight by kind of building off our first point. You see, waiting on the Lord, sometimes you don't have to do that. If you're waiting on the Lord to be saved, you don't have to wait any longer. We give you this invitation that we have a baptistry right back here, and that's what it looks like. And we've got places where you can change so that you don't have to get your clothes wet. You could get our clothes wet. And we can have you confess your faith in Jesus Christ right tonight. And we can baptize you for the remission of sins. And you can start on that pathway of being in the kingdom of Jesus Christ, headed for heaven and eternal life. Don't have to wait any longer. So won't you come as together we stand and as we sing. Thank you.